When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
Welcome to The Sidetrack. I'm Jason Williams. Last week on the show, I talked a little bit about the importance of 2020 from almost a philosophical perspective when it comes to America and who we are and who we're going to be, and not in any way trying to gloss over what's just happened in this country when it comes to the Oval Office and the politics surrounding our even our legislative process at this point. Watching the news as these shooting tragedies play out and the basically auto-reply responses from so many elected officials who would call themselves and allow themselves to be called leaders in a lot of capacities, just showing absolutely no ability whatsoever to lead. And that's not unique to the Trump era, but it's definitely concentrated and under the magnifying glass here in the Trump era, to say the least. Having a conversation with a friend of mine who's living overseas for the time being, not because of Trump, although the timing does make it look that way, overseas for personal and professional reasons, looking at the possibility of professional reasons bringing him back to the United States. And he said, you know, I try to follow as much as I can, pretty busy over here. Tell me honestly your opinion that is America going to get its shit together in 2020? I honestly don't know, because I remembered having a conversation with this same friend living here in the United States, November 7th, 2016, panicked over the presidential election coming up the next day and the possibility of Trump winning. And I, like so many others, said, look, the odds of him winning are so low, I don't think it's going to happen. Obviously, I was wrong, and so was everyone else. And just as a little tangent, because it's a pet peeve of mine, no, the polls were not wrong. Every single polling average and predictive model out there gave Trump a chance. And quite frankly, he just beat the odds. The polls, when it comes to the popular vote, were actually pretty on. Again, he just beat the odds. And as I discussed in some of the earliest episodes of this Sidetrack series here, it's not fair to call it a fluke, but he did, to a large extent, get lucky. And he only needed to get lucky in a handful of places, a few counties in Pennsylvania, another couple here in Wisconsin, etc. So I struggle with how to talk about this in a way that isn't repeating some of the things that I hear and read out there that to me personally are very frustrating. Talk of Trump as if he were some sort of fluke is dangerous, I think. Not recognizing that this is who we are as a country is just way too convenient for white people. And in fact, I think is directly tied to how we end up with a racist in the White House in the first place, by pretending that it isn't out there. And I think it needs to be confronted. And that's what I've been trying to say here in the last couple of episodes. But stepping away from that immediacy that I think is really important to keep in mind, and stepping back a bit into some of the more academic or even intellectual pondering avenues that you can explore when it comes to the United States right now and the upcoming presidential election, all of this under the idea of presidential elections being a statement, if you will, to ourselves and the rest of the world, this is who we are. Now, granted, no voter goes into the polls. Well, actually, I think a lot do, but the majority of voters don't go into the polls with that in mind. I'm going to vote this way because I want to send a statement to the rest of the world and to everyone here in this country. But in a way, that is kind of what we're doing. And it is something that, looking back on an election, is unavoidable when you're trying to process what a country just decided, what the majority of voters in a country just decided. What are they saying? What kind of country is this? What direction is America headed in? These are normal, natural, smart questions to be asking. And so I think with that in mind, the upcoming presidential election is a huge opportunity, as I've talked about already, for Democrats, for the party itself, for whoever becomes the eventual nominee of the party, for voters in this country disgusted by what they're seeing, regardless of how they voted in the past. There's an opportunity there to send a message and to say no to everything you're seeing. But the idea that Trump embodies all that's wrong with this country when it comes to some of these themes that keep bubbling up again and again in his political career, primarily racism. I mean, this is a guy whose political career began with birtherism and questioning Obama's education credentials. And then when called on that, as meekly as the media was apt to do at the time, he deflected and said, "I'm just asking questions. I'm just not being politically correct. Don't call me a racist for asking these questions. I think we should ask these questions of the president." Well, no, this whole idea, the whole driving motivation of birtherism and what drove people to latch on to that conspiracy theory as a potential truth, or for a lot of them, the truth they still believe today, was a combination of being stupid people and racism. Fact of the matter. So, you know, you throw all this together into a big pot and you ask a question like, what's going to happen now? It gets overwhelming. There are so many moving pieces to what happened in 2016, the rise of Donald Trump as the face of something that had actually been rising in Republican or conservative movement circles for decades. It never went away, but it was growing. It was gaining power. And then Trump comes along and basically just starts saying the quiet parts out loud and really pours some gas on that fire. It was all there before him. And here's the really scary part. It's all there after him. Whether it's impeachment, getting booted in 2020, or God forbid, just the end of his second term and he finally has to go away. Regardless of which one of those happens, what Trump embodies and is giving voice to is still going to be here. And white people, this is on us. That said, there are a lot of players in a presidential election. So I want to talk about some of those this week, primarily the media and the role the media did play and will play again in the presidential race. Playing out right now in the Democratic nomination portion of the race, you see similar elements to what played out in 2016 for Republicans. And the media basically, you've seen these reports that most of the coverage of Trump from the media, if not almost all of it, in 2016 was negative, was critical. And that's true for the most part. The only outlets not being critical of Trump in 2016, as he was still fighting for the nomination, were right-wing, incredulous news sources, like Breitbart and that moron Jim Hoft, Gateway pundit. So that is true. It was highly critical. And I think for a lot of people, they point to that and say, well, that should have stopped him. But what everyone's missing here is, actually, we've got to go back a layer again. That's why this is so complicated. Trump is not a strategic genius. A lot of what I'm going to talk about here gets prescribed to him mainly by very not creative pundits that just latch on to the laziest thing they can find and then call it an intellectual conclusion and write it up. And the New York Times says, oh, goody, this is great. It's laziness, and it should be ignored outside of just keeping tabs on them. Trump is not a genius. Surprise, right? He's not strategically smart. he's not, I think at times in Trump's career, he has been smart enough to surround himself with the right people. And that may still be true of his presidency and the campaign that led to it to some extent, although I think even that's fair to question at this point. But he himself is not a genius. He is not playing three-dimensional chess with the way he conducts himself. What he's doing is being, well, honestly, he's being that guy that we all know. That guy that acts this way and does and says these things and responds this way when called to the mat over a falsehood or a misstep or a stupid decision. We all know this person. It might be someone you work with. It might be someone, you see a lot of these that you've seen at a big business event. They're very, very frequent there, and that's probably not coincidence. numerous there. These are people we all know. It's not rocket science, literally. This should be so obvious to anyone paying attention. And I think for most general people out there following the news somewhat to very closely, it is obvious. They may not recognize it, but they see Trump on TV. They hear his tweets being read. They maybe watch a bit of the incessant coverage of his rallies. And there's somewhere inside of them, the connection is made. They know this guy. They know him. And at that point, it basically comes down to a very simple mechanism. This either repulses you, excites you, or because of your own personal privilege, you're somewhat indifferent to it. Those are the three possibilities. Another way to say that is, yes, if you support Donald Trump, still, let's give everyone a pass. We shouldn't, but just for the sake of this podcast, let's give everybody a pass for 2016. So here we are headed into 2020. If you support what you've seen so far for re-election, black and white conclusion here that cannot and should not be muddied. You are either one, a racist yourself, two, okay enough with the racism that it doesn't bother you, or three, too stupid to be driving yourself to the polls, please ask for help. It's one of those three, period. And no amount of Bret Stephens faux intellectualism in the New York Times opinion pages, no amount of deflection and dissemination from your Republican friends, family members, and colleagues, none of that changes the simple fact it has to be one of those three if you are supporting this guy for re-election. And that applies to every elected official out there who hasn't come out unequivocally stating they are opposed to it, which basically means almost every elected Republican you know, regardless of which state you're listening from. So that's the sorry state of where things are at for the Republican Party and therefore for the country at the time. With the election, of course, Democrats, it's fallen on them to rescue us. And personally, I think there are a lot of Republicans out there hoping Democrats do exactly that without having to support it themselves, which is the very definition of cowardice and craven behavior. But we'll put that aside for a minute. What happened in 2016 with Donald Trump, as far as the media is concerned, as far as the main mechanism for information getting out there, was not some strategic genius of Donald J. Trump or the campaign he put together around himself or someone put together around him, it's looking more like. What this was a person that we all know, acting the way we all have seen this type of person act in our lives in some aspect. And the media in 2016, especially during that nomination contest, being completely unable to cover it responsibly. Every Trump rally for a long period of time, while there were still a lot of Republicans on the debate stages in that 2016 GOP nomination contest, every Trump rally getting wall-to-wall coverage. If not live broadcast, it was happening the next day with every panel on CNN, MSNBC, and of course, Fox News. What else are they going to do, though, right? That is enough. I think there were a lot of other things involved in Trump getting elected. But that's enough right there to make him the nominee. And that's important. Not just so you can point the finger and say, like I like to say often, the cable news sucks and you shouldn't watch it. That's still true. Absolutely true. But we saw that in the debates. Honestly, DNC, if you ever let a cable news network host a debate again, you're just being irresponsible. It's the nature of their business. It's the business model itself, but it's also the fact that, I mean, quite simply, here you have this person running for president saying these things and doing these things. And for cable news especially, a lot of other media was affected by it as well, but for cable news especially, they couldn't stop themselves. They didn't know how. This was made for them, this guy and his campaign and his rallies. This is exactly what cable news is all about. How could they turn away from it? And they didn't. And you saw this pop up just a little bit in the CNN debates for the Democrats. The CNN debate, you have Jake Tapper basically trying to start a fight, literally cutting candidates off in thoughtful, complex answers to important policy like healthcare and immigration. And he's cutting them off because they're not arguing with each other, cutting them off and saying, what do you think about that? Generic white guy that does not have a chance of ever breaking 1%. What do you think about what the two front runners just said that wasn't an argument? Can you turn it into an argument for us? And that was literally what was happening. Which argues that no lessons have been learned. And here, it's probably unrealistic to expect cable news especially to learn some of these lessons. Beltway media at large, the DC media class, they have no excuse for being as naive as they're still being. Cable news, I'll at least cut them the slack in saying, look, this is TV 24/7. If they have something that's going to fill a lot of time, be controversial, and get everyone tuning in because all their friends are saying, oh my God, did you see what's happening or just happened? That's what cable news has always been about. So I cut them a bit of slack for that, but not entirely. And this is all coming again. So, great article written just last week by a man who I've only met one time before, and he was screaming in a hallway at a political conference because the panel had been moved and the sign hadn't been changed. So he kind of scared me. That's what I'm saying. But he's a very, very intelligent writer and pops up only occasionally in U.S. media. He's a columnist for Al Jazeera. His name's Paul Rosenberg. But writing last week at Salon, he breaks down all of the current science, from political science to sociology to, in this specific article, cognitive scientists who are trying to help the media process and understand how this moment plays them. Not Trump, because he's not that smart, but who Trump is and the way a person like that acts naturally, just being that kind of a douchebag, how the media can't fight it and isn't prepared to fight it, but how easy it would be for them to do so. The title of the article, if you'd like to read it yourself, is Trump Dominates the Media Through Twitter. We knew this, but now there's science to help us. Rosenberg writes in the article, Donald Trump has mastered Twitter like no previous politician, but more importantly, the media keeps enabling that. And what he describes in the article is the same thing I've set up here. Trump is no genius. You've heard this argument before. Oh, Trump's just trying to distract us. Don't fall for it. Well, no shit. You'd have to be a moron to not see that behavior from the president. I mean, this started with WikiLeaks dropping stolen documents an hour after a tape hits the media that in any sane country would have ended a political career permanently. 1 hour later, WikiLeaks drops one of their biggest document dumps. That's so obvious, right? But the same thing plays out almost daily, at least weekly, but sometimes daily, with the president and just his Twitter account. Obviously, he's trying to distract and deflect. This is what authoritarians do. This is what people who are built entirely on a house made of bullshit do. This isn't rocket science. You're not a genius for pointing out the president is just trying to distract us. That said, you cannot ignore, especially when it comes to the racism, what he's trying to distract us with. And this is what completely boggles me about this argument. It's almost like saying, look, we can't expect the media to inform us in two ways at the same time, or to inform us about two different aspects of a single event or story at the same time. Really? We can't expect that. We can't ourselves seek it out? That's too much to ask? I don't think so. And that, to me, is what that argument is conceding. It's saying, look, you can only pick one thing to pay attention to at a time, period. That's how we all work, and it's what we've agreed upon. No, horse bucky. This is, you are capable of recognizing that the president might tweet some racist, jaw-dropping, disgusting thing to distract you from maybe a lawsuit he's losing or an investigation that probably should have him in jail right now. No shit, he's trying to distract us. But you don't have to pick one or the other. And I'm worried, as much as I'm seeing this argument from the candidates in the Democratic Party right now, I've almost every candidate except Sanders and Warren and Harris has come close to saying this. Basically, let's just ignore the president. Now, I've heard this from every Republican right now in the never Trump category. Let's just pretend there isn't a president. No. You don't get to do that. I mean, technically, none of us get to do that. It's an irresponsible approach to anything relating to public policy. You don't get to just pretend this isn't happening because it happened to be your party that enabled it and, in fact, constructed it over several decades' time. No, you have to, in my opinion, pay attention to what the president just said, tweeted, or drew on a piece of paper with crayon. The man's name is Stephen Lewandowski. He is a cognitive psychologist in Australia. And in Paul Rosenberg's article at Salon, he talks about, a lot of research, but he focuses primarily on Lewandowski's work on language and what is known as a topology of a person's speaking, writing, or expressive behavior in general in some way or form. That the theory behind this is that every person has a way of going about this, and it's impossible for them to authentically go about anything that isn't natural to them. Or another way to put that is when it comes to the president's not some genius exacting some sort of mind-bending strategy to twist the media around his fingers and keep the public confused, but rather this is just who the president is. Certain people have to learn this behavior because, honestly, they amount to nothing else in their own minds and in reality. So they build a cocoon around themselves of this type of behavior, and it allows them to sort of float like a particularly dry piece of cow shit on a river. And that is the president. And Lewandowski, of course, uses much more fancy language to describe this, but he basically says, what we've established in our research is evidence to support the view that President Trump systematically uses Twitter to distract us from the issues that he finds threatening on a personal level. Lewandowski says, up until now, this was supported only by anecdotal gut instinct example, and a lot of people noting that Trump would tweet extensively about, say, Lewandowski writes, a Broadway play, haranguing the performers. This is an actual thing that happened, haranguing the performers. At the same time that he settled the lawsuit against Trump University. So Lewandowski says that our study provided quantitative evidence, not only for the distraction, but even more strikingly, the media response to the distraction. So basically what they did is they took from April 2016 to August 2017, they took the president's tweets, and from a cognitive psychologist's perspective, working with a linguist, George Lakoff, who had already written extensively about this, they took his research and combined it with their own, and they built basically a model of the president's online-only language from April 2016 to August of 2017. And then they contrasted that with events that happened before, during, or after, both in the real world and on the front pages of newspapers and the cable news shows. And they looked for patterns. And what they found is a pattern that looked very much like a press running interference for Trump and shielding him from public scrutiny, rather than exposing him or calling him on his bullshit. Lewandowski writes, obviously, this, well, at least probably, isn't what was happening. The press probably wasn't campaigning for Trump in 2016, nor propping up his presidency in its first few months until August 2017. Highly unlikely that's the media, what the media was doing, but it really looked like that's what they were doing when you contrasted the president's tweets and media behavior before, during, or after those specific tweets and events that were happening at that same time, rating the events on whether they were positive or negative for the president. So again, they looked at the president's language. They looked at the media's coverage of events before, during, and after the president's tweet rant. And what it really looked like is, well, the coverage changed. And the coverage changed in such a way that, again, Lewandowski says, you could almost say the media was running interference for the president. He ties this all to what Lakoff calls the ontologies of language. And he talks about the systemic lies that align closely with what he says cognitive psychologists call anti-reflexivity, or the defense of a person or a system or a thing that scientists and social movements over the year, scientists have seen in social movements over the years. And he talks about a different type of basically muddying of the waters. He talks about curated lies, and he uses examples from recent history like the weapons of mass destruction narrative the Bush administration was putting out, where so the Bush administration, to put this in my own words, they're being as honest as any presidency can be about 95% of what's out there, so that the 5% that they happen to know is absolutely false also gets believed. And Lewandowski says this is one way of forcing a cognitive reaction from the public, from the populace, but even more importantly, the media. So you have good faith with the media because 95% of what you're doing is holding up, is standing up. And then the 5% that you probably know is pretty shaky and maybe even completely false, also gets sucked in by the media with that other 95% and becomes a truth in and of itself, at least long enough to serve your purposes. And he uses the weapons of mass destruction narrative from the Bush administration as an example of these curated lies. Basically, lying used very minimally to achieve an agenda and going the extra mile to make sure everything else is on the up and up so that those lies slip through and get repeated by the media. And he points out this is traditionally what most people expect from politicians, president or city council, and it's also something the media expects and oftentimes actually is doing its job well enough collectively to catch these things, at least eventually. And he describes that again as curated lies. Then he uses this other example of what he calls systemic lies. And he points to times to Lewandowski says it's important to remember that, again, Trump is no genius. Trump isn't latching on to something that hasn't been a part of the Republican Party for a long time. And Lewandowski uses a couple of examples from Republican policy history of when the same type of behavior the president is exhibiting on a regular basis was used. He points to right-to-work laws. Or I'm sorry, Rosenberg adds these examples in his article, not Lewandowski. Rosenberg gives three examples of when the Republican Party has done exactly what Trump's doing now on a more limited basis. And he points to right-to-work laws, laws that are basically designed to weaken labor unions and mechanisms that, like collective bargaining, that are there for workers, hard-fought rights. Right-to-work laws basically undo them in one single swipe. And if you look at the language around those laws, Rosenberg writes, that it's a great example of how Republicans just, they weren't trying to sell people on right-to-work laws. What they did instead is just splatter the place with horse shit. No one knew what to think or what to believe. And that created an opportunity to swoop in and get right-to-work laws passed like they had never been able to before. Currently, my personal example, I think religious liberty bills. I mean, these are bills that if you really ever look at the language of a lot of these religious liberty bills, they're basically just designed to enshrine discrimination of one type or another. And the examples often used to defend them don't even apply. It's just basically throwing a whole bunch of garbage out there in the hopes that nobody will ever be able to find the stuff that isn't garbage. And then while everyone's confused, you can just, you know, find your opportunity and get it passed. Rosenberg gives another example in his article. That's my example. His other example is focus group generated terms that conservative think Frank Luntz, very successful at. It's so disgusting to see Luntz on Twitter these days, too, because he's woke now. But he's basically responsible for some of the biggest piles of steaming excrement that have ever plagued our political discussions and debates, policy or otherwise. He's the man behind a lot of death panels and death taxes. Job creators, family values, junk science, partial birth abortion. He didn't invent fake news, but fake news is basically from the Frank Luntz playbook. So all of this is meant not to, as Rosenberg writes, it's not meant to persuade, but to bludgeon. It's not meant to convince people to agree with your argument on why they should or should not support this or that. It's more meant just to confuse the hell out of everybody until no one knows what to think. And everybody's spending so much time trying to beat back the bull that your opportunity eventually inevitably arises and you can just get this thing passed. It's a very short-term way to look at public policy, and it has a lasting damaging effect. See the orange racist in the White House right now as one of the greatest examples of what can come of this type of political behavior. Lewandowski in his research, Rosenberg recap, says that curated systemic lies like those have been, they've been the bread and butter of movements forever. If there is lying at all, it's done selectively and carefully, and it's mixed in with a majority of truth. And Rosenberg says conservatism has embraced this at least since the Reagan years. In fact, it was part of Reagan's shtick. But really, the roots of this go back even further in the overall political system. It's just been a bit concentrated on the right in America for the last several decades, and there's a reason for that. When your ideas are no longer publicly popular, well, you've got to do something, right? Trump, Lewandowski says, their research shows, represents something completely different. And Rosenberg describes what Lewandowski's conclusion is the conclusion that Trump and a lot of people around him and a lot of people in the Republican Party now feeling energized to follow suit are so prolific with the lying that it's actually impossible for the media and the fact checkers to keep up. Eventually, they are so underwater that they just basically give up. And you combine this with political science and cognitive psychology's own research into, you know, our partisan behavior. Short and sweet of this is if someone from our chosen partisan group says something, we are much more inclined to believe it or to defend it as truth, even when presented with contrary evidence. You combine that which is just human nature. That's basically laziness on all our parts. And we all do it. We all pretend we don't, but we all do it. And that's probably not going to change anytime soon. So you combine that with just overwhelming everyone with lies. And what you get is literally a post-truth environment. Truth, what is true and what isn't true doesn't even matter anymore. The only thing that matters is what the largest group of people currently believes to be true. So fact-checking doesn't matter. Credible media and reporting doesn't matter. What matters is who's winning the war when it comes to bullshitting. Rosenberg writes that it's a mix of what was known in the Bush years as a shock doctrine, where you just kind of overwhelm someone with a couple of tidbits and then you get no opposition. It's taking that to its extreme. And it's almost a constructivist view. There's no such thing as truth, just competing stories. And whose story is being repeated the most. Lewandowski, in his research, says this is basically where the president exists. And has his entire life, if you really peel the layers back. But now he's in the White House. And now he's sort of pulling the media along on a string, tossing out shiny nickels here and there when convenient. Lewandowski says there is a really, really simple solution to this that is actually used in a lot of cognitive therapies out there. For example, someone who has been in an abusive relationship where they've spent a good number of years being gaslighted and convinced that they're crazy and that they're the ones with the problem and that the only reason their marriage didn't work is because of their mistakes. The other person was just trying so hard. Lewandowski says that when it comes to cognitive psychology and therapeutic solutions, this is a really common thing. And it's really simple thing to beat. To put it in my own words, the solution that Lewandowski recommends, and this is just mind-boggling that the media is not up to this challenge, because the solution is basically throw out these, I think, overly simplified arguments that, oh, the president is just trying to distract us. Don't pay attention. No, pay attention. Absolutely pay attention. Especially when it's racism. That's been the most offensive thing to me over the last several weeks, is that you have these same people saying, just ignore the president. No. The president is a racist. You can't ignore that. You shouldn't ignore that. But why does not ignoring that end the story? So sure, the president might say a crazy, even racist thing, to distract you from, say, the testimony of a high-profile figure in American politics talking about an investigation that basically said if the president weren't the president, his ass would be in jail. So you go out and you tweet some racism because that'll excite your base and you're willing to risk you won't pay for it here in America, which is sadly a not-so-risky risk. Obviously, that's what the president's doing. You can't ignore it, though. You can't. And furthermore, and this is where Lewandowski heads with his executive summary of their own research in the published paper, he said, this is so simple in cognitive psychology. If you take what is taught, if you will, to people trying to overcome a situation where they've been in an abusive situation and they've spent years being convinced by abusive significant other that they are the problem. It's so simple. He said, if you translate what works in helping a person overcome that type of an experience and begin to see themselves as capable and more whole again, and apply that to the media of today, in respect to how do you deal with Trump and still do your job responsibly, it's this simple. Don't ignore the president. Take the bait on his distraction anytime you want to. But take a few minutes to report on what he's trying to distract us from at the same time. Now, Rosenberg, the more political person here in this two-name ensemble I keep quoting, you've got Lewandowski, who's the researcher publishing a paper. You've got Rosenberg, a political activist and Al Jazeera columnist, who is taking that research and turning it into a political argument. Rosenberg concludes that this is important. It's not going to change minds, but that's not the point. The point is, Rosenberg says, is, well, from this section in Lewandowski's paper that reads, the literature on agenda setting basically invokes multiple actors with a primary focus on the media. They are seen to be the principal agenda setters. It's a nuanced literature and evolving rapidly now, but it's pretty clear that in the past, the media were agenda setters, whereas now, in the Trump era, it's being handled over to social media and fake news. In short, Trump's use of social media to shape coverage of him needs to be seen as a larger, long-term shift. And Lewandowski's team, Rosenberg says, found a distinct, statistically significant impact. They found words, for example, that Trump used more frequently after any news coverage cycle that spent a lot of time on Mueller and the investigation. They did targeted analysis using keyword combinations from the president's own chosen language and found these diversionary trends. They found the use of the words jobs, China, North Korea, wall, and immigration to be the president's most frequently used words any time Mueller was dominating or the investigation was dominating a news cycle. They found that in their expanded analysis, they found that there were word pairings that the president used. In fact, they narrowed it down to 150 word vocabulary that the president would go back to again and again. And they revealed patterns. And they found that, yes, the president was using them to an attempt of diversionary effect, but they also found, for example, that the word job or jobs was presented in 56 out of 73 diversionary word pairs when he talked about, for example, hating the New York Times. Interestingly enough, they also found an almost exact same number of the mentioned Trump and jobs word pair in New York Times coverage at the exact same time, meaning the diversion worked. They found the exact same thing for ABC News, CBS News, and NBC News. The diversion worked. Why, though? Because the president's a genius playing us all? No. Because the media falls for the diversion and then pats themselves on the back. Job done. We told everyone what's happening. No, you didn't. You fell for the diversion, which, again, I defend because I don't think we should be ignoring this gas bag in a suit. But then you didn't follow that up in the same story or in supplemental stories by saying, oh, by the way, here's what the president was trying to divert you from. It's laziness. Lakoff calls it a truth sandwich. And I recommend you spend some time reading Lakoff, at least following him on Twitter, because he really makes this stuff so much more simple than I'm even doing here, and I'm trying my hardest to keep it simple. Lakoff calls it the truth sandwich. He says you start with the truth, the first frame gets the advantage. So you start out with something that's true, or at least mostly true, and you do that early enough that you win the frame game. Then you indicate the lie. Avoid amplifying the exact language used, but indicate the lie, point out the lie, and then return to the truth. Make sure that every story published talks about the truths more than the lies. You don't have to ignore the lies. You don't have to, quote, not take the bait and ignore the president's tweet even. You just have to make sure it's sandwiched with the truth or what he was trying to distract everyone from, or the truth about reality around what the president said that wasn't true. My point here is this is not difficult. This is more easy than what is expected out of most undergraduate college students working on research papers. We should be able to expect that out of the media, especially legacy media. But I think this includes cable news, despite the pass I give them on their business model. I think they can do this. They just aren't. Lewandowski and all of the research involved basically conclude that in the 2016 presidential election, from the nomination contest to the general election, the media inadvertently ended up normalizing Trump and pathologizing Clinton, which is actually the reverse of the reality contrasting those two candidates. And he says, as I pointed out here, the majority of media coverage was actually very critical of Trump. But even the critical coverage of his outrageous behavior, sometimes disgusting, shocking behavior, ultimately just turned into free publicity for him. The reason this works is because his base considered him authentic because of the disgusting behavior. They were deplorables in baskets, by the way. The lying demagogue thing works for people who like lying demagogues, because the lying demagogues are saying what those people have been thinking quietly for a long time, mostly racist stuff. And this shouldn't be hard for the media to not fall for. Critical coverage doesn't necessarily harm a candidate, especially if you're literally just throwing what the candidate said or tweeted out there, acting as a giant megaphone for the deflection, the distraction, and the decimation, the muddying of the waters until no one knows what's true. And all the media has to do to not facilitate this is a truth sandwich. Start with the truth, talk about what the president said, maybe even point out he was trying to deflect or distract, and then wrap the story up with the truth again. Not difficult. The question Rosenberg wraps up this whole article with is a simple one. Can we stop this, or at least stop from making things worse? He says that in his time in the media, which now amounts to a couple, 3 decades, he said, he's an older guy. He said, absolutely, I think we can stop contributing to the ongoing destruction of democracy through our behavior as members of the media, as information blasting organizations. Trump's base is by far not a majority, not even close, he writes. To the contrary, one safe red state like Texas, he also says Arizona, Georgia, pick one, are close to becoming electoral battlegrounds. So politically, it's absolutely possible, he says, to reclaim democracy from what's happening all around us right now. It's not lost, in other words. But it's going to require the media ceasing and desisting in letting Trump set their agenda. And again, I think that this is laziness, not lack of skill. I absolutely don't think the media, outside of a couple of crackpot right-wing publications, are in cahoots with Trump or even want to keep him around. I just think it was impossible for them not to give him free coverage during the nomination because he was so out there. It was nuts and a bit racist, well, a lot racist. You have CNN playing these rallies in 2016. Almost, if you go back and watch some of the coverage, the hosts are covering this almost like, can you believe this shit? Huh, surprise, the guy's president now. And again, not a huge change for the media to combat this. I personally think ignoring the president, I get why Republicans are doing it, you know? I might be inclined to do the same if I in any way, shape, or form was associated with the man in the White House right now politically. I might try and pretend that wasn't the case. But they don't get a pass on that. Your party, your circus, your monkeys. But for the rest of us, even otherwise intelligent progressives that I've heard say, just stop paying attention to the president. No. I think the president himself gave us the greatest example with his go back to where you came from tweets with the tragedies in the news over the last several days of mass shootings within 24 hours of each other, coming just weeks after the president jokes with his supporters at a rally about shooting them as a solution to immigrants. United States senators like Cornyn from Texas tweeting about invasions and white people being bred out of a majority in this country. This is not separate from Trump, Republicans. If you're not saying something about it, if you're not even acknowledging it, I mean, hell, you just as well be endorsing it. And you should also be ashamed of yourself for your cowardice. It's cliche to say, but silence at this point is an endorsement. It's always been true. It's always been a cliche statement. But it's really what's on the line right now for the Republican Party. They're hoping to get a pass. If Trump gets 4 more years, no chance in hell. And hopefully, even if this all ends with impeachment before the election, please, or the election itself, okay, fine, good enough, Republicans still shouldn't get a pass on this. And hopefully, we have a media that doesn't help that happen. I'm skeptical. We'll see whether they can learn this lesson in 2020. But just one more time, it's not like the media needs to rebuild every business model. It's not like the media at large, be it cable news, print, legacy or local, radio. Radio is a bit different. It's not that what needs to happen here is going to require burning it all down and setting it all back up. No, all it's going to require is grassroots accountability that's going to come through, yeah, p- people bitching at Barry Weiss on Twitter. Sorry, Barry. Part of the game, and you earned it. But also, holding them accountable. Making a to-do out of laziness. Local, national, it doesn't matter. It's going to require independent media, like The Left Show. It's going to require a big effort that comes from outside of the large media body that dominates national conversations for the most part. But again, the only thing that needs to happen is the truth sandwich. Some simple accountability. A realization that it's not a choice about either paying attention to the president or completely ignoring the president. No, that's a false choice. Repeated all too often these days. What it is actually is a choice of whether or not you report what the president said, did, or again, drew on paper with crayons, and include in that report what the president was distracting us from or what the president is lying about. You make sure that the truth and the deflection, distraction, decimation coming from the president are included at all times with the truth sandwiching the bullshit. You go a long way to making it impossible for the president's deflection to have the effect that Lewandowski's research says it has. Again, New York Times, ABC News, NBC News, CBS News, Lewandowski's research, he and his team found that not only is the president using Twitter, just Twitter, to distract and deflect and have the media running around, not only is he doing that, but if you look at the coverage, the language used and how it matches the president's own, it's not just that the president's doing it, it's that it's working. I'm Jason Williams, and I'll see you next week.